Okay, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:35 p.m. on Wednesday, March 15th, 2023. And present today, we've got a full House, Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Ortiz, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Actually, might be missing one. So before we start, just if we could all mute our cell phones. And this afternoon, we'll hear House Bill 62, which is the extension of the Renewable Energy Grant Fund, then presentations from Legislative Finance Division and Legislative Legal on the mechanics of the Constitutional Budget Reserve vote, reverse sweep, and effective dates. So first up is House Bill 62, which is the plan today is to move the bill from committee, if the committee so desires. This will be the second hearing of the bill, and we have heard public testimony, and we had no amendments. So at this time, I'd like to ask the sponsor, Representative Edgman, as well as his staff, Mr. Allensworth, to briefly summarize the bill and make any comments or answer any final questions. So with that, Representative Edgman, you're welcome to answer questions from your seat, and Mr. Allensworth, you could please come up to the table and maybe put yourself on the record and any opening statements before we go to possible questions.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you for bringing the bill up today. Just briefly, House Bill 62 proposes to increase, to reauthorize the Renewable Energy Grant Fund program for an additional 10 years till 2033, and that's the extent of the bill. And if there's any detailed questions or an explanation of the fiscal mode necessary, my staff, Leib Allensworth, is at the table.
Great, thank you. So before we go to the fiscal note, any questions on the bill itself? I see no questions. And just for the record, I just want to mention that we've also got Representative Colomb with us. So with that, again, we had no amendments. And so Co-Chair Johnson, if you could please walk the committee through the fiscal notes for HB 62.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Fiscal note number one is a zero fiscal note for various departments, appropriation for Alaska Energy Authority, allocation, statewide project development, alternative energy and efficiency, OMB component number 2888, control code WUJ, capital W, capital W. We have someone from Alaska Energy Authority online to answer further questions if necessary.
Thank you. And Mr. Allensworth, do you have anything to add regarding fiscal notes?
For the record, Leib Allensworth, staff to represent Benjamin. I just wanted to clarify, it is a $1.4 million fiscal note already included in the governor's budget.
Okay, thank you. And if we could take a brief at ease. Okay, and House Finance back on record. And so just to clarify, the fiscal note is a $1.4 million attachment to that fiscal note. So with that, are there any questions regarding fiscal notes? See no questions. So also I do want to mention that we do have somebody from the Alaska Energy Authority online, Mr. Curtis Thayer, the executive director, if there are any questions, but I don't see any questions. Sure, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair for Mr. Thayer, if I might.
Representative Josephson, and then Mr. Thayer, if you could put yourself on the record when you do answer the question. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Mr. Thayer, the $1.4 million, what is the appropriation in FY23 for these administrative costs?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it is $1.4 million. That is an average of what it costs to run the program, and so we just maintain that going forward. Some years it's a little bit less, sometimes a little bit more, but it averages to be 1.4.
Thank you.
Thank you. So I don't see any further questions. And with that, if the committee so desires, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee. Representative Johnson.
I move House Bill number 62, version 33-LS0385-A from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
Okay, thank you. Are there any objections? I see no objections. So with that, House Bill 62, version 33-LS0385-A is reported out from the House Finance Committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes. And we'll take a brief at ease and allow folks to go ahead and sign the committee report, and then I'll turn the gavel over to Representative Johnson, and we will move over to the second part of our meeting. So with that, thank you very much, Mr. Ellensworth, and we'll take a brief at ease.
House Finance is back on the record. We will now hear a presentation from or on the mechanics of the Constitutional Budget Reserve vote, the reverse sweep, and effective dates. Presenting today, we have Emily Nauman, Director for the Legislative Legal Services, and Alexi Painter, Director of Legislative Finance, and I think we have someone. I think we have Megan Wallace here from Legislative Legal as well. And I guess I'll just say, go ahead, Ms. Wallace, go ahead and put yourself on the record and start your presentation and make that work however it works for you.
Great, thank you. For the record, Megan Wallace, Legislative Legal Services. As you mentioned, I am going to go through an overview of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, also referred to as the CBR for those that are watching at home, and the reverse sweep. We'll go over the mechanisms for the sweep, and in light of all of the recent litigation surrounding the CBR and the sweep, we will go through that recent litigation and the impact that it's had on the historical analysis related to the sweep, and then finally go over an overview of effective dates and any potential for litigation surrounding passage of effective dates. Ms. Nauman's here if you have questions for her, and Director Painter is available if you have specific fund-related balance questions as we go through the mechanics of the sweep. So we're going to start discussing the Constitutional Budget Reserve sweep mechanism, but before discussing the details of the sweep, I probably should have included a slide with the full constitutional provisions relating to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. Those are found in Article 9, Section 17 of your Alaska Constitution. Subsection A of Article 9, Section 17 establishes the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, covers what deposits are made and investment of the fund. And then subsection B, which has been the subject of litigation in Hickle v. Cooper that we'll go over later in the presentation, subsection B establishes a formula by which the legislature can access the funds in the CBR by a majority vote, and that provision looks at the amount available for appropriation and compares it to the amount that was appropriated in the prior fiscal year. And then subsection C of Article 9, Section 17, that allows for an appropriation from the CBR for any public purpose upon approval of three-quarters of both houses of the legislature. So all of the deficit spending reverse sweep mechanics are appropriations under subsection C of Article 9, Section 17, of the Constitution. Getting into...
Oh, I just had a chair. Thank you. I'd like to just ask a quick question. The Section D was, it shows in my Constitution here that it was amended in 1990, but Section 17, where it establishes the Budget Reserve Fund, was that an original Constitution? In the original Constitution, that section, was that part of the original Constitution?
Madam Chair, all of Section 17 establishing the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund was approved by the voters in 1990. So A through D was all approved in one constitutional amendment and was in the Constitution starting in 1990.
Thank you.
So the Constitutional Budget Reserve sweep, or the CBR sweep, that is often discussed in this committee and the Finance Committee and the other body, that is referring to the repayment requirement in subsection D of Article 9, Section 17. And what it says is that if an appropriation is made from the Budget Reserve Fund until the amount appropriated is repaid, the amount of money in the general fund available for appropriation at the end of each succeeding fiscal year shall be deposited into the budget reserve fund. So what that means is that any money left in the general fund that is available to the that is available for appropriation is effectively swept into the CBR, which is why we refer to it as the sweep.
Okay. Representative Josephson.
Through the chair for Ms. Wallace. Remind me, Ms. Wallace, this debt is not like a Visa card debt where I would be dunned or served with papers in a lawsuit if I didn't pay. This no one's coming to our door, and no one's writing us a letter, and there's no penalty or fee for not repaying the CBR. Virtually nothing happens. Is that true?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, that's correct. There's no specific enforcement or penalty if the legislature does not repay the amount owed to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. The only consequence is that we will have a sweep every year until the amount is fully repaid.
Oh, Representative Scapp.
Through the chair to our wonderful presenter folks. I'm curious, it says the amount of money in the general fund available for appropriation. Can you define amount of money, quote, available for appropriation, the context of that, especially regarding the earnings reserve account?
Representative Stapp, we have many slides that are going to discuss litigation and the interpretation of available for appropriation. If you want to wait till we get to that point, and
happily defer. Thank you.
So the sweep occurs by operation of the Constitution under subsection D, and historically, the legislature occasionally the legislature decides to pass what's called a reverse sweep. So to emphasize that the sweep happens every year automatically by operation of the Constitution. You can never stop the sweep from happening. But what you can do is pass an appropriation that we now refer to as a reverse sweep, which essentially just is an appropriation back out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund that returns all of those sweat funds back to the original general fund subfunds or accounts from which they came from. And the reverse sweep, like I mentioned, is an appropriation out of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So that is an appropriation under Article 9, Section 17C, that requires a three-quarter vote of each house of the legislature to be approved. The sweep happens effectively at 11:59 p.m. on June 30th by operation of the Constitution. And if the legislature approves a reverse sweep, that that goes into effect essentially 12:01 a.m. on July 1st. When the reverse sweep passes, or if a reverse sweep passes, the only sweep that actually occurs is an accounting event involving the reconciliation of accounts for the end of the fiscal year. So to summarize that, if the legislature passes a reverse sweep appropriation, there's just an accounting shore-up that happens on paper, and that's the only actual sweep that occurs. If you're interested in a little bit more details on the mechanics of the sweep or how it really works, these slides were stolen from probably a presentation that myself and Mr. Painter gave previously, and I think the Division of Audit has talked to the legislature previously about how the administration's Division of Finance and the auditors carry out the sweep. And just quickly, the Department of Administration, Division of Finance, accountants calculate the sweep while they're preparing the ACFR, which is the Annual Comprehensive Financial Report. And the sweep represents unreserved, undesignated general fund or fund balances of the general fund subfunds. And so those Division of Finance accountants calculate the amount of the sweep in September as they're preparing the ACFR, and the amount of the sweep is posted in those financial records at the end of the fiscal year. The ACFR is prepared historically at the end of October and then is audited by our legislative auditor.
I'm sure.
Representative Josephson, but then I would like to try to go ahead and ask your question, and then I'll try to figure out how.
I looked ahead. I don't think this is taken up. I could be wrong. Through the chair, Ms. Wallace, am I right that the key agencies that voice opinions on what's sweepable are not in agreement? That is OMB, Division of Legislative Finance, Division of Legislative Audit. There may be some significant overlap where they agree, but there's not total agreement on what is subject to sweep.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, there has been moments of disagreement between different agencies, whether it's between legislative finance, OMB, the legislative auditor, maybe legislative legal has different opinions, but ultimately the entity that carries out the sweep is the administration. The Division of Finance carries out the sweep, and if they make an interpretation or execute the sweep in a manner that others don't agree with, as you will see, there has been litigation over those decisions.
Thank you.
Let's go ahead and try to make it through, like, take a stop at like page 8 and maybe page 11 for questions, maybe every 3 pages, looks like.
And we can move pretty quickly through this slide. This is just to give you a little bit of background information about the CBR provision and an old statute that the legislature passed. So as we talked about, the constitutional amendment was passed in 1990. The legislature attempted through enactment of Alaska Statute 3710-420 to implement the sweep. But that statute was challenged in court in the case of Hickel v. Cooper, and the Alaska Supreme Court found the legislature statute unconstitutional in 1994. And the legislature has not ever passed a new statute or attempted to redefine what funds are sweepable. And so absent any new law, the administration has historically looked to court cases, particularly Hickel v. Cooper, to make decisions on interpreting how the sweep is to be carried out. And so Hickel v. Cooper was decided in 1994. A lot of the case centered on to determine within subsection B what is meant by what is available for appropriation. And through Hickel v. Cooper, there is a two-part test that is established to determine whether or not a fund is sweepable under Article 9, Section 17D. And so the two parts are, is that a fund needs to be in the general fund and it needs to be available for appropriation. And in terms of what it means to be available for appropriation, in Hickel v. Cooper, the Alaska Supreme Court specifically held that funds that are held that can be expended without further legislative appropriation, meaning the administration or some other state agency can expend those funds without the legislature having to make another appropriation, are not available for appropriation for purposes of the sweep. And that's because those agencies could essentially spend all of the balance of those funds at any time without further appropriation or action by the legislature. On the other hand, funds that do require appropriation or require the legislature to further act before they can be expended, those funds will be considered sweepable under the Article 9, Section 17. So Hickel was the law of the land. Well, it still is the law of the land, as we'll get to, but we didn't have any other cases interpreting the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund or the sweep for about 25 years. And in 2019, however, the administration decided to expand the scope of the sweep and included additional funds on their sweepable funds list. And most significantly at the time, the list was expanded to include the Power Cost Equalization Fund, or PCE, and the Higher Education Investment Fund, sometimes referred to as HEIF in litigation or as an acronym. And following the expansion of the sweepable funds list, particularly with these two funds that carry significant balances, litigation followed. And so we've had litigation over the last few years. We've had cases go to the Alaska Supreme Court that are changing or have an impact on interpreting and applying the sweep. And so the first of those cases is AFN versus Dunleavy. This is the Alaskan Federation of Natives lawsuit that was brought against the administration challenging the determination that the PCE fund would be sweepable. There was a Superior Court decision in 2021 in favor of the plaintiffs. It decided that PCE should not be swept on grounds that PCE is a separate fund outside the general fund. By statute, that fund is established in the Energy Authority. It's not established in the general fund. And so the administration decided not to appeal that case to the Alaska Supreme Court. So we do not have a Supreme Court decision on the sweepability of PCE, but that that case and that order would bind the administration with respect to the PCE fund. Of note, however, is that in that Superior Court decision, the Superior Court specifically noted on the topic of whether or not the fund was established in the general fund, the court noted that the legislature has created other funds or other separate funds outside of the general fund and listed some of those examples in a footnote 77 of that opinion. And in that footnote, the Superior Court specifically noted that the legislature had established the statutory budget reserve fund in Alaska Statute 3705-540A as a separate fund in the state treasury. And so after analyzing that decision, our office advised that it would be our opinion that if a court were to look at the sweepability of the statutory budget reserve fund, that a court would likely consider it to be outside the general fund and not subject to the sweep because it's not in the general fund. It's established as a separate fund in the state treasury.
All right, we'll pause for questions. Seeing none. Go ahead. Oh, wait.
I'll wait for the one.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Staff, if you'd like. Okay. All right, we'll proceed on.
Following the PCE decision, in 2021, the legislature failed to pass a reverse sweep appropriation. And following the failure of that sweep, the Attorney General wrote an opinion advising that money that had already been appropriated from the Higher Education Investment Fund for the upcoming fiscal year could be spent and was not sweepable despite that appropriation not yet going into effect, but maintained that the Higher Education Investment Fund's corpus would still be subject to the sweep. And so what that meant was that, as you know, the earlier slides indicated, the sweep is a constitutional mechanism. It happens on June 30th at 11:59 p.m. But the Attorney General advised that because the legislature, it was his opinion that since the legislature had essentially validly committed that those funds for the upcoming fiscal year, even though those appropriations had not yet taken effect, they wouldn't be swept, but the remaining balance or the remaining corpus of that fund would be swept into the general fund. And so scholarships were paid for FY22, but a group of students challenged the governor's decision that the remaining balance should be swept and alleged that none of the higher education investment fund should be sweepable. Ledge Council also participated in that lawsuit as an amicus party and filed briefs supporting the students' position. Just this fall, the Alaska Supreme Court issued a full explanatory decision and concurred with or affirmed the Superior Court's decision that the Higher Education Investment Fund is a sweepable fund. The court noted that the HIF fund was available for appropriation under the Cooper test, particularly because the legislature has to appropriate those funds by law before those monies can be spent. In other words, the executive branch doesn't have the authority to just spend money out of the Higher Education Investment Fund. The legislature has to first appropriate those funds. And so the Alaska Supreme Court specifically held that fund under the Cooper test was a sweepable fund. And it's notable that the parties argued and before the court that the court should consider overruling Cooper or changing its test, and the court refused to do so. And so the court specifically upheld its Cooper decision and the test that it enumerated in the 1994 Cooper decision. The other notable thing, though, particularly as it relates to the Higher Education Investment Fund, is that this litigation surrounded the statute as written at the time of litigation, and last session as part of Chapter 15 SLA 2022, which was known as HB 322, amended that statute. And so that statute now provides that the Higher Education Investment Fund is a separate fund in the state treasury, and it's no longer established specifically in the general fund. Part of HB 322, the legislature also reestablished the Alaska Marine Highway System Fund, which is found in AS 1965-060A, and the Alaska Marine Highway System Vessel Replacement Fund, which is 3705-550A, also as separate funds in the state treasury. Further, while the Supreme Court upheld the sweep of the corpus of the Higher Education Investment Fund, the legislature did pass a supplemental fund transfer as part of last year's budget, HB 281, and reconstituted that fund. After the governor's veto, the legislature redeposited $342.5 million into that fund. And given the statutory changes, that fund was not swept as after the fund is no longer in the general fund. So in the legislature, as you all know, you love acronyms and to term things by little nicknames. And so something that came up in 2021 is the idea of the scoop versus the sweep. And the scoop is this idea that I talked about before, in which the appropriations made for that fiscal year are scooped up and not made part of the sweep. And so that came to be after a 2021 Attorney General opinion advised the governor that it was legally defensible to not sweep the FY22 funds that were appropriated in the budget, even though they had passed and not yet taken effect. And so the governor ordered that FY22 appropriations that had not yet taken effect but had been enacted were not going to be subject to the sweep. And so that concept has been coined the scoop. In the Short v. Dunleavy litigation, which is the Hype litigation, the Superior Court addressed this issue and had said that while the Higher Education Investment Fund, as was in statute at that time, was available for appropriation and it was sweepable, but that it was okay for those FY22 appropriations to not be swept. The Superior Court essentially reasoned that the money is no longer available for appropriation because the money can now be expended without further legislative action. And the decision was affirmed by the Alaska Supreme Court, but the court did not specifically analyze that scoop portion of the Superior Court's opinion, so we don't have any further dialogue from the Alaska Supreme Court, but that decision was affirmed. And when we are talking about the scoop concept and effective dates, that leads into kind of questions about special effective dates. And under Article 2, Section 18 of the Constitution, laws passed by the legislature become effective 90 days after enactment or by a two-thirds vote of each House, the legislature can provide for special effective dates. Different than special effective dates are retroactivity clauses, and a retroactivity clause does not amount to a special effective date. So there has been litigation on this before, and the Alaska Supreme Court has confirmed that the legislature can make a law or an appropriation retroactive, and that retroactivity provision can be adopted by the legislature with a majority vote as opposed to the two-thirds vote necessary for a special effective date. Going back to 2021, when the legislature initially passed its budget, it did not approve the special effective dates for the budget. And as you all know, there are many different effective dates that tag along to appropriations. Supplemental appropriations generally take effect before July 1. Appropriations for the upcoming fiscal year take effect July 1, and you know, some may have delayed effective dates. And when we talk about appropriations that may or may not take effect before July 1, there becomes a government shutdown discussion. And so there is some historical attorney general opinions that have seemed to advise that the governor or the administration might have some flexibility to rely on retroactivity provisions to keep state government open while they wait for the bill to take effect 90 days after. But in 2021, the Attorney General filed suit against the Legislative Affairs Agency, alleging that the agency had improperly advised employees that the legislature might essentially stay open despite a government shutdown because that the retroactivity provisions could enable the legislature to continue to work. And so the Attorney General filed suit alleging that the legislature essentially was claiming to be able to spend money before appropriations had gone into effect and litigation ensued. That case was ultimately dismissed by the Superior Court on grounds that the action was prohibited under Article 3, Section 16 of the Constitution, which prohibits the governor from suing the legislature. But that case is still under appeal, and we're awaiting a final decision from the Alaska Supreme Court. So that case is still pending. And the takeaway from that litigation is that in order to avoid litigation or uncertainty over effective dates or government shutdown, that the legislature should probably adopt special effective dates on appropriation bills.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Ms. Wallace, I was tracking beautifully everything you've said, except on this slide, and I'm just confused. I'm familiar with all these cases, but Taylor. And so on the one hand, my memory of 2021 is that Treg Taylor, in this legislator's opinion, did a huge service to the people of Alaska and the legislature, because we were at an impasse, and he basically blessed all the appropriations, at least for, in that case, FY22. Albeit saying all these corpuses are going to be swept. But that gave us a lifeline to go home and get through the year, and I saw that as a blessing. But here on this bullet point, you're saying he sued because he denied that there was an effective appropriation, and that seems to be either I didn't hear you right, which is very possible, or it runs counter to what I've called the Treg Taylor memo, which was the summer of 2021, the memo I've just discussed.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, you're correct. So these are two distinctive issues or positions. You know, I don't, your summary of the opinion related to the scoop or allowing the FY22 appropriations to be spent and then just the corpuses being swept was one issue. And then this second issue came up, and I think it's a matter of opinion whether those are consistent or not. But yes, this Taylor versus the Legislative Affairs Agency litigation surrounds the Attorney General's opinion that the agency improperly alluded to the fact that they might have the power to stay open and expend money absent those appropriations not yet having taken effect.
I just can't. I can't make a motion. But that's it. Thank you.
Representative Hammer.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Let me start with a question to you, which is Mr. Painter presenting to us on this today also, or is he here as a lifeline?
I believe that Mr. Painter is here, that he can answer questions, and we can ask him to come to the table and give full explanation. So, but I don't expect him to come up and give a presentation.
So then I'll start my question then, and I see that Mr. Steininger is also here. And in my freshman term, learning about the sweep was, you know, a startling thing to try and wrap my head around. And what I am interested in, because this presentation has touched on the big funds and the litigation, but I remember there being a list of the what had been for a long time, as it was described to us, an agreement between both OMB and Ledge Finance about what were sweepable funds and not sweepable funds. And sort of ignoring the big two that led to litigation, the variety of smaller funds that, I guess for lack of a better description, things that carry over from year to year because that was good governance, licensure fees that were paid for a two-year cycle, but suddenly those funds were going to be swept in that year. And I can't quite remember, but I do remember seeing a list of them produced and the nexus of where the disagreement between OMB and Ledge Finance and the Department of Law about how those funds were defined as being sweepable or not sweepable, that they'd had much agreement up for a long period of time, and I'm wondering whether Ms. Wallace is the right place to answer them or those guys.
Well, let's find out. Three for these. On the record, we have Lexi Painter's director for Ledge Finances came forward. I think he has an idea of how to answer that question and will give a thorough explanation.
Thank you. For the record, Lexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division, through the chair, Representative Hannon. So I think Legislative Finance is not really a player in this, and that we don't have opinions about what funds should be swept. Legislative Audit does. As the auditor, we do not. But So there's sort of multiple sweepable funds lists that have been floating around between, you know, what has actually swept, meaning what Division of Finance has executed, what the Department of Law, when they and OMB and the Division of Finance looked at those funds in 2019 and changed the scope from what the Division of Finance had done, and those were implemented in future sweeps. And in some of those, I believe the legislative auditor actually agreed with the changes, that some of the funds that they had been holding out of the sweep, the legislative auditor indicated that, you know, she agreed that those should have been swept. But because there was always a reverse sweep, it was sort of an academic issue. Until there was no reverse sweep last year, and suddenly, or in FY20, and then suddenly it became not such an academic issue. And then, again, I don't think the legislative auditor necessarily disagreed with the list that actually swept. She has disagreed with the scoop provision. That was an audit finding in the FY21 statewide audit. But I would say from the practical standpoint, last year the legislature and governor made a series of changes to the budget to cope with the fact that there hadn't been a sweep and there was not going to be one in FY22. And so last year there were several funds where the legislature in the budget last year changed the effective dates from the previous version. Instead of depositing revenue collected through June 30th into a fund on July 1st, those appropriations into the fund happened on June 30th. Because in the meantime, you know, over that course of the day between June 30th and July 1st, some funds were open to the sweep during that transition. Just by changing effective dates in some cases, there was no more issues with the sweep. And those were mostly the DEC funds for the spill prevention response. There were a number of funds where the legislature and governor decreased appropriations from funds that were subject to the sweep to bring revenue and expenditures in line instead of spending down fund balances because those fund balances were no longer available. So now there are probably fewer issues if a reverse sweep is not adopted because many of those changes have been made in the budget. But we can still see in the supplemental this year that there are still impacts because the purpose of these funds sometimes was to deal with volatile revenue. So, for example, there's a supplemental in the governor's supplemental request this year for the Department of Labor where there's an unusually high number of, can't remember exactly what the program is, but a program where there's claims paid out and in an inconsistent way from year to year, the revenue comes in and then they may have higher or lower claim activity. And then in this case, the revenue and expenditures didn't match up because there was no fund balance. And so we have an unrestricted general fund supplemental to make that up. And so I think the consequence essentially of moving to not having a reverse sweep for the last 2 years has been that we spend more from the unrestricted general funds on a year-to-year basis. However, some of those revenues end up lapsing to the CBR at the end of the year instead of staying in those funds. We do not yet have audited financials for FY22, which would enable us to sort of see how the second sweep after the sweep that cleaned out a lot of funds, how that operated. We don't have that information yet because that audit has not occurred or has not been finalized. So I think currently, I'm not sure that there's really disagreements among the finance people about what should be swept. At this point, you know, it's kind of gone to litigation where people like me who are not attorneys don't generally try to weigh in on items that are in front of the Supreme Court. So it definitely gets above my pay grade. So I'm not sure that there's lingering disagreements other than with the legislative auditor and the scoop provision.
And follow-up? I found it particularly helpful in understanding it. And again, sort of ignoring the big two that have gone to litigation. But by legislative policy, the number of places that we've required Alaskans to pay fees to the state for licensure, investigation, things that bridge multiple fiscal years, those smaller funds in Department of Labor, Department of Commerce, ADF&G. You're doing test fishery in one fiscal year, but then you're executing some use of it in the following fiscal year. Do we have a sense yet of how many of those kind of small funds that we swept them, which may seem like a good policy, but then in the end we've taken what was designated revenue paid for out of licensure or required fees by policies we've set, and then swept it into the general fund and then say, well, now we got to recapitalize this to carry out the duty, whether it's business license investigations or execute ADF&G research that was funded out of fees collected, and then the next fiscal year we don't have it. And I just don't know if that's all sort of cleaned up now, or we're going to, maybe we wait for the audit to go. We've got 50 other little funds that we need to make sure there's the money to do that.
It's a very long question, but hopefully we can get a succinct answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannon, yes, I'll try to keep my answer shorter this time. So in the absence of having audited financials for FY22, really the one sweep we have to look at that was not reversed is FY21, which was, of course, the first one that was not reversed. So there's going to be a lot more balances caught up in that one of funds that were inactive or funds that are, you know, had gained a significant balance over the years that was not being used. We would expect that the FY22 sweep would be relatively minimal, and that future sweeps should be relatively minimal unless we're drastically misestimating revenue, which is a possibility. But again, without seeing those audited financials at this point, I think it's difficult to do more than speculate about how that might look in practice.
And we have on our list Representative Edgman followed by Representative Stapp.
Well, I really appreciate this presentation. I'm sitting here thinking that that someday we'll have a presentation where we can actually contextualize how the CBR came about, why this crazy counterintuitive thing called the Constitutional Budget Reserve ever was put in the law. And to get to Representative Hannon's question, my recollection is in 1990 when it was voted into law, that was the era of oil tax disputes with oil companies, hundreds of millions of dollars involved. The CBR was essentially set up as a fiscal stability tool, a lockbox, if you will, that with a supermajority of three quarters of the legislature was required to tap into. But between the formation of the CBR in 1991 and the onset of declining oil revenue in calendar year 2014, the CBR was, the three quarters vote was routinely employed. It was not weaponized, if you will, as it was later on in terms of the minority party, both Republican and Democrat, using the CBR as a means to get what they wanted because of the three-quarters vote, given that in 2014, all those reserves we had built up in the 2000s when oil prices went from single digits in the 90s to all of a sudden triple digits, and we were getting money, thanks to an oil tax change during the Sarah Palin regime, hand over fist. So all of a sudden, we had like $16 billion in the CBR that in 2014 we had to start tapping. But in order to tap it, we had to have a three-quarters vote, which led subsequently to special sessions of 2015, 2016, 2017, 2019, 2021 that were prolonged and carried throughout the summer and sometimes into the fall. But the point I'm trying to get at is we didn't really have to test a lot of the theories or everything that the presentation today has sort of put forth until we got to that era of calendar year 2015 and whatnot. Because before that, the CBR really didn't play that big of a role in terms of funding state government, making up the deficit that was in place. And it was a pro forma vote on the House and Senate floors, the three quarters vote. Now it's a heroic task to get three quarters votes out of both bodies, and really has become a tool that you either employ or you assiduously avoid. So But to me, that's the backdrop that helps understand this crazy counterintuitive thing called a CBR, which is the ultimate lock boxes of lock boxes. That when the debate was taking place, if you talk to a few legislators who are still around, there's a gentleman in the audience who was here, there was a real push to make that three-quarters a two-thirds vote, not a three-quarters vote supermajority, but it ultimately ended up being three-quarters vote, and the party in the minority at that point ended up being in the majority, and then it all got it was used against them. But I think I really appreciate you allowing me to ramble here a little bit, but to contextualize this thing helps really understand all these machinations that have since come about, the legal cases, the really winnowing in and having to define that agreement between OMB and Alleged Finance, which basically, as I remember, was a gentleman's agreement, right? But then until it became a contested sort of environment with the CBR, the gentleman's agreement kind of went away and things got a lot more scrutinized. And henceforth, the court cases and, you know, bringing it all to where we're at now.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair to Ms. Wallace and one of the folks of the presenters. So I'm going to share with you one of my deep-seated fears here that I have after listening to this and contemplated on. But first I'd ask you, can you define what the Cooper test is that you mentioned earlier in the presentation? What is the Cooper test?
If you go back to slide 6, the two-part Cooper test in terms of defining whether or not a fund is sweepable is that it has to be both in the general fund and available for appropriation.
So follow-up, Madam Chair. So in the Constitution of the State of Alaska, in it says Article 9, Section 15, it says, the last sentence regarding the permanent fund says, quote, all income from the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund unless otherwise provided by law. And when I read the Cooper case, it states that the earnings reserve account is effectively not subject to appropriation because, quote, all income from the permanent fund shall be deposited in the general fund otherwise provided by law. The earnings reserve account is established as a separate account in the fund. Income from the fund shall be deposited by the corporation into the account as soon as it is received. Therefore, money in the earnings reserve account never passes through the general fund and is never appropriated as such by the legislature. So my question is, does the legislature appropriate money from the earnings reserve account?
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, yes, the legislature appropriates money from the earnings reserve account now for several purposes. At the time of the Hickel decision, the legislature had only ever appropriated money from the earnings reserve account for payment of permanent fund dividends. And anecdotally, that notion from the Supreme Court that the legislature didn't appropriate that, the Supreme Court corrected that in the Wilikowski decision, that misstatement.
Yeah, so last follow-up, Madam Chair. So I assume you probably know my line of questioning here, so I will defer to our legal experts, of course. My fear is because of this sentence about requiring additional appropriations that we may have effectively made the entirety of the ERA subject to the sweep provision, and I hope that I am wrong.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, the Supreme Court did address that later on in Hickel. In footnote 32, it notes that because the earnings reserve account is established outside of the general fund, it's established in the permanent fund, which is not part of the general fund, that the earnings reserve account essentially fails this two-part test because it doesn't satisfy the first component, which is that it's not in the general fund. So Hickel noted in footnote 32 that the earnings reserve account would not be subject to subsection D or the sweep. And then we have the decision in Short from 2022 that reaffirms the Hickel case and the Hickel precedent. So for the time being, it appears as though the earnings reserve account is safe from the sweep.
Thank you, Ms. Wallace.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Ms. Wallace, Hickel also talked or spoke to endowments and trust funds, did it not? So it seemed to say that those were separate because the way they're designed and created, they're designed to be self-sustaining, and so they're not available for appropriation. Do I, or at least I, they don't pass one of these two tests. Am I right about that?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, you're correct that the endowment trust funds, like the Public Employment Retirement Trust Fund, like those funds have not been historically swept. Hickel does talk a little bit about trust receipts and that they are counted as available for appropriation, but in the context of, for example, you know, federal funds or trust receipts that the legislature actually does appropriate for the purposes for which they are created are counted only for purposes of Article 9, Section 17B in that calculation in terms of whether or not the legislature might be able to access the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund on a majority vote. But historically, because of the balance of the earnings reserve account, that the legislature has not been able to access the CBR under that provision.
I think, Madam Chair, it also includes federal dollars. We're not allowed to sweep those. But my next question relates to, sort of relates to what Representative Hannon was talking about on these accounts where for the expense of the Border Commission, for example, the nurses pay $1,000 a year, whatever they pay. I'm reminded of a current example that is may reach us here, and that is Representative Prox's bill, which said, if you'd like to gift your PFD to the government, here's how you do that. Has there ever been a test of whether we can sweep those sorts of, and I know you got into this with Representative Hannon, and I don't want you to have to repeat yourself, but that there's something that seems off about that.
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, prior presentations from the OMB director indicate that also, like, donations for a particular purpose are not sweepable. So those are also not on the sweepable funds list.
And last question.
Yes.
Through the Chair, for Mr. Painter, and I don't think this is too far afield, Madam Chair, because we've talked about the three-quarter versus 51% vote. We have a revenue projection coming out soon. Do you have an opinion on whether to spend money from the CBR before we adjourn, we need three-quarter vote or 51%, 21-member vote?
Through the Chair, Representative Josephson, just have to revise my math given the decrease in the price of oil today. But generally, because of the balance of the earnings reserve account, we have not gotten particularly close to that majority threshold. I think we're still several billion dollars away. One thing I would note with that comparison of the previous year appropriations is that calculation is done in all appropriations, including not just unrestricted general fund appropriations. So the closest, you know, when we've calculated in the past, the closest we got to majority votes was when we had appropriated $4 billion of inflation proofing in the permanent fund the previous year, and that counted as a previous year appropriation that got us closer. This year, because the inflation proofing in FY23 is estimated to be now about $4.2 or $4.3 billion, we do get closer than expected, I think. But unless the ERA, something very bad happens with the ERA, I think we'd be still a few billion dollars short.
Thank you.
All right, next up we have Representative Colomb.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, this is probably to Mr. Painter as well. So I'm a little confused on the funds that can't be swept. I was going to ask about the funds that are under the Department of Revenue, which I thought the Higher Education Fund was in that. But like I was thinking, like the Exxon Valdez oil spill account, are those not sweepable because they're in the permanent fund account, or are they separate? I guess my question is, which one are those all unsweepable, or some you sweep, some you don't?
Through the Chair, Representative Colomb, so the list in statute of funds, you know, funds within the Department of Revenue. So the Higher Education Fund is in the Department of Revenue statute, but that statute has been modified so that it is not in the general fund and therefore is not subject to the sweep under the current understanding. The Exxon Valdez oil spill is not available for appropriation or other than the amount that we appropriate each year, because appropriations of that fund have an external, it's not up to the legislature whether we can spend those funds. It's up to the trustees, which are a mix of state and federal trustees. Another one in that statute would be the Public School Trust Fund. That's a pre-statehood trust, so the amount available for appropriation each year is only the amount of trust receipts that are in statute available, which is the POMV draw out of that trust, not the entire balance, because that would be a violation of that trust. So I think, you know, that available for appropriation part can be difficult sometimes with that, these trusts, you know, where is that line? I think usually, and this maybe Megan can correct me, usually it would just be the only part that could be potentially subject to the sweep would be the amount that's available for appropriation if the legislature chose not to appropriate that, because otherwise it would have an obligation against it and would not be able to be swept.
Okay, thank you. All right, we have Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. My question is pretty minimal here. I had a question, I think, for Meg Wallace. It's around the appeal decision for the case that you referred to in slide 13, Taylor versus LAA, back in 2021, and there's an appeal to it. Wondering if you have a sense of the timing for that decision, if you've heard anything.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, that's the million-dollar question. We have no idea. It could come out next Friday. It could come out 6 months from Friday. We don't know.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-Chair Edgman.
Oh, the annual question. Actually, it's more of a statement. But just to put on the record once again, it seems like we've done this for a number of years, that under the Wilikowski decision that the court established that the legislature's power to appropriate, which is constitutionally created, rises above anything that might be in statute. Is that basically the case?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, from a general, very general perspective, that's correct. The legislature maintains that power to appropriate, and if a statute recommends that the legislature appropriate money based on a particular formula or a particular percentage, the legislature gets to make that decision each year as part of its budget process in terms of whether or not it's going to follow that, essentially a recommendation by a prior legislature, or if it's going to appropriate more or less than is articulated in statute.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I don't see any additional questions. I think there's a lot of, thank you for your presentation. There's just brings up a lot more things to think about for certain. But with no additional questions and no further business before the committee, I will actually tell you about tomorrow. The next presentation, our next meeting will be, or I guess I can say thank you to both of you, all three of you. Thank you for coming up and clarifying. I always appreciate having you. I haven't seen you this year, I don't think, Ms. Wallace. Thank you for the presentation. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, Thursday, March 16th at 1:30 p.m., and we will receive two presentations. The first will be from the Alaska Housing Finance Dividend Program. Presenting will be Brian Butcher, the Chief Executive Officer of HFC. And then the next presentation following that will be on the from the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority and the Alaska Energy Authority Dividend and Power Cost Equalization Programs. Presenting for ADA, we will have Randy Roraro in person with
Jeff Johns, the interim CIO, and Amy Adler, the acting CFO, online for technical questions from committee members. Presenting for AEA will be Curtis Thayer, the executive director. And with no more business before the committee at 2:46, we are adjourned.